everyone. I'd like to convene the May 23rd, 2013 session of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We are convened. Good morning to everyone. I'd like to thank our guest presenters here this morning. We're going to have an informational meeting on cormorants, and I open that informational session. And I would like to invite forward, please, Richard Hannon, Nanette Sato, and I'm going to hold there for a moment. Oh, Ron, come on up. Didn't mean to cut you off quite so quick. Good morning to each of you. Welcome to our committee, and we want to express our appreciation for the fact that you bring your expertise to this informational hearing. We are very grateful for that. And please decide among yourselves the order of your presentations.
Good morning, Chair Whip, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to talk to you about cormorants. We met with Chair Witt and Representative Krieger's Cormorant Committee here a couple of weeks ago, and the chair thought it would be very worthwhile for us to come in and talk to the full committee, and also the request to bring the service down and be able to have some discussions with them about cormorants and how our programs fit together. So just as some background information for you, cormorants are classified as a migratory bird and covered under the various migratory bird treaty acts, which puts them under the federal purview, and then the states have to collectively work under those federal regulations and guidelines for any implementation relative to management. We've heard lots of information in the past. I'm sure you've read information about the Lower Columbia River and some of the impacts that Caspian terns and cormorants have been having in the Lower Columbia River. The Lower Columbia now has the largest breeding colony of cormorants in the world. And it's one that's kind of an unfortunate type situation that it's literally, from a biological standpoint, you never want to have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, like that, because if something goes wrong, then you have a major problem that you have to deal with from a biological standpoint. We have documented predation impacts through various studies on the Columbia. There's very real concerns about that and whether those are also occurring in coastal estuaries. And working with Representative Krieger and at his urging, the department has been looking at cormorant issues in coastal estuaries for the last 3 years. The department has elevated this within the Pacific Flyway Council for various implementation of management plans and monitoring plans to develop population information. And we've been providing Representative Krieger's Cormorant Committee updates as we've been going along over the last 3 years. The most recent one from a couple of weeks ago is one of the handouts that we've provided to you. That shows the things that we're currently working on. We've been working towards acquiring a federal depredation permit that, if granted, would allow us the opportunity to do targeted cormorant management in the coastal estuaries. There's some requirements associated with that permit. You know, being a government agency, we all have hoops that we have to jump through, and we find it rather ironic that we're having to jump through hoops ourselves as a government agency, but that's just the reality of it. And some of that information includes diet studies and the hazing projects, which we've been funding through the work that Representative Krieger's done to secure funding for us. We've been doing hazing work in several of these estuaries trying to minimize impacts, and we've been increasing our efforts to monitor birds and to document breeding colonies outside of the Columbia. We have specifically trained one of our staff to assist the Fish and Wildlife Service in analyzing the aerial photographs that are taken of the breeding colonies. We've signed off on the Pacific Flyway Council's survey and monitor plan, which will expand our survey efforts across the whole state in conjunction with the Fish and Wildlife Service as a partnership. And we're working with the research efforts on the Lower Columbia, where they're banding birds to track dispersal of birds that are displaced from the Lower Columbia. As part of those efforts, we're looking for bands in the coastal estuaries to see if we are in fact seeing movement of birds out of the Columbia into other areas, and just continuing to work through our various processes. So our handout, I won't go through it. If you have specific questions you'd like to ask about it, I'd be happy to jump into that. And we do have a relatively stable to slightly increasing population of cormorants here on the West Coast on this particular population of birds. We have seen some shifts in coastal estuaries of some of the breeding colonies are no longer as being used as much as what they were historically, but the overall number of birds at the breeding colonies is essentially the same, and we continue to partner with the Fish and Wildlife Service on looking at how best to move forward with management of these birds. So Chair Witt, that kind of captures kind of an introductory, and I'd like to turn it over to Rich and Nanette at this point.
Thank you very much. Before you turn it over, Ron, typically committee members, we go through the panels and ask questions. But in this instance, there may be questions that you have specific at the state level, and I'd like to afford the opportunity for you all to ask questions or make comments before we move on to our guests from Fish and Wildlife. Representative Krieger.
Not at the last cormorant meeting, but the one before, it had a gentleman down, and I don't know if he was from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but he addressed the issue about the banded birds and that they had not found them on down through the estuaries to the south, only a couple, and they would have expected a much larger number. And then he went and said that those birds appear not to be migrating south into those estuaries in any numbers. And then he went on to say that they do move north into Puget Sound for a period of time before returning to the mouth of the Columbia. Do you recall that?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, that was Dan Lyons, Dr. Dan Lyons,
yes,
with Oregon State University, who's been working with Dr. Roby out of OSU on the research on the Lower Columbia. And it has been our understanding from previous work that's been done that the birds typically have moved to the north. So we are wanting to verify that, and that's why we are looking for these bands on cormorants in the Oregon coastal estuaries to see, as they do some of the displacement work in the Lower Columbia, are things happening the way we expect them to happen based on our previous knowledge. And so far, this last spring, we've documented four banded birds that came from the Lower Columbia that have been in the Oregon coastal estuary. So it's not very many, but we don't know. The bands are very difficult to see. You think if you have any experience with cormorants, typically when you see them, they're flying at about 75 miles an hour, about 2.5 feet off the water, and seeing those bands as the birds fly by, bands on their feet, can be quite difficult. So part of our efforts, we're looking to put some people out on the ground over the course of this next biennium during the spring and the summer months to do population inventory work, verification of breeding colonies, and also looking for bands to help verify some of the things that that we feel are happening with the Lower Columbia population of birds.
You also mentioned, I can't remember how the context was, but same population. And what I'm wondering is, are you saying that that population has sometime in 2006, 2008, whatever you want to say, got to a kind of a, to a certain level and it's not increasing as much? Or do you feel that it is still growing? Or do we have that information even?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure we have that information real well at this point in time. The inventory of cormorants has not been a real high priority for either the states or the service. There's been periodic inventory efforts that have been done, and it gives some kind of long-term pictures, and we are fairly confident that long-term this population of cormorants has declined since the early 1900s. We also are fairly confident that there's been some shift of birds that historically were in southern British Columbia and in Puget Sound, and that there's been some shift of birds out of those areas down to the Columbia and East Sand Island. And, but unfortunately, we don't have a real strong data set that we can say that definitively or with any level of confidence. And that's what the Pacific Flyway Monitoring Plan is designed to do. And we have a comprehensive survey methodology laid out now that the Western states will be implementing over the course of the forever, and be able to provide us with that excellent baseline information on the population.
Just one more of a statement, I think, for our federal guests. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Study with Oregon State University on Nehalem was kind of eye-opening for us that when we first saw it, basically 50% of our out-migrating, both hatchery and wild, were being taken. Some of the preliminary stuff, I believe, on the ALC indicates that. Of course, the Columbia, we know. And so there's about a $57 million investment per biennium in the federal and state hatcheries in Oregon and up the Columbia. And if you extrapolate that, that's over $1 million a month or over $250,000 a week that we're allowing to be eaten by a bird that's not protected, or at least it's not endangered. And I don't think we can continue to have that kind of loss to our economy and the potential opportunity while we try to prove something that probably most people already know as a fact. I think that you folks, I know you're going to get into it, Mr. Hannon, you were at our meeting. We appreciate you coming down. And it seemed like it was pretty positive, but that was over a year ago. I don't know what we've, the movement is too slow.
Representative Krieger, so that we can be very specific on this, that study and your own computation of perhaps $250,000 per week, was that take of hatchery broodstock?
That was hatchery broodstock, and we're not counting the fact that, according to the other studies, it's probably an equal number of wild fish, which is even more alarming because those wild fish were having trouble recovering.
Yes.
And there's a lot of restrictions on both sport and commercial fisheries on certain places because of the uncertainty of the wild population.
And did those studies single out cormorants as the cause for that predation?
In the Nehalem study specifically, and also the Columbia, but simultaneously in the Nehalem study, they kept track of seals' presence. And they had a chart, a horizontal chart, and the counting of seals' presence, also the out-migration that they recognized because they were releasing them at the hatchery and then checking through screw traps to pick up what was going through there from the wild, is that when those fish started down, the seal population came up like this, went right along till June 15th when they quit the out-migration, and it dropped off. You could just almost lay one right over the other. So obviously seals also are having an impact on smolts, not sea lion seals. There's a difference.
But the monetary figures that you've computed were related specifically to cormorant predation.
Yeah.
Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, I'm not very knowledgeable on who, what eats salmon smolt and steelhead smolt, stuff like that. What effect, Ron, does the merganser have on it as well?
And Chair Witt, Representative...
It's obviously a diver.
Escobar. We have not looked specifically at that. I don't know that we see the numbers in the estuary. We don't see the numbers of mergansers like we do with cormorants. If there is an impact, it would probably be more upstream and within the river systems themselves. And frequently at the time of the year that you have your out-migration of smolts in the spring, they're high water events. And within the river system, it makes it, it's probably a little more difficult for mergansers really to have that significant of an impact because those smolts are riding out on those water surges versus when you get down into the estuary and the fish get more concentrated and they're in the larger schools, then I think it the chances for cormorants and their impacts can be more significant than the mergansers up river.
I was just wondering because we have a lot of those on the upper Rogue. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
All right. With that, again, would like to welcome Mr. Hannon and Ms. Sato, and we appreciate the expertise that you bring before us today. I appreciate your appearance. Please proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you about something that I know important to you and it's important to us as well, and that's double-crested cormorants and their impact on fisheries. And also, I'll try to shed some light on our ability to manage those birds.
And if I might interject just for a moment, would you please identify yourself?
I'm right. Sorry. Yes. I was just getting ready
right.
to do so.
Thank you very much.
My name is Richard Hannon. I'm the Deputy Regional Director for the Pacific Region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Pacific Region encompasses the states of Oregon, Idaho, Hawaii, Washington, and then also the affiliated Pacific Islands. Accompanying me is Nanette Sato. She is the chief of our Division of Migratory Bird Management, and she works with me. We both work together in Portland.
Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much. As Ron said, double-crested cormorants are migratory birds, and as such are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Those birds are also subject to four international treaties that we have with adjacent nations. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has the management authority for all birds under the Migratory Treaty Act, which is about 1,000 birds, cormorants being one of those. The North American double-crested cormorant population is divided into five geographically based subpopulations, and I'll refer to several figures that you may want to look at as we go along. Those five sub-populations are the Atlantic, Southeast, Interior, Alaska, and the Pacific Flyway, we being in Oregon and Washington and the Pacific Flyway. If you refer to figure two, figure two shows that about 70% of the entire population of double-crested cormorants occurs in the interior population. That includes much of the Midwest, many of the interior Canadian provinces, but that's where 70% of the double-crested cormorant population lies. Approximately 5% of it is found in the Pacific Coast and the Alaska population. So I just wanted to give you a magnitude of where these birds are located. The remaining three subpopulations account for about 25% of the population of this bird within our hemisphere. The total number of double-crested cormorants in North America was at an all-time low in the 1970s due to the impact of DDT. The populations after DDT was banned increased rapidly from the 1970s to the 1990s, but overall, the growth rate slowed after that period. From 1990 to 1994, the North American population of approximately 372,000 breeding pairs increased about 2.6% annually. This increase was driven by a 6% annual increase in the interior population. So overall, the population was increasing about 2.6%, but the real driver of that increase was in the interior population, not the population that we have here in the West. As an example, in the Great Lakes, the interior breeding population grew from near zero in 1970 to 250,000 pairs by 2007, a huge, dramatic increase. This increase was a result, again, because of reduced levels of environmental contaminants, particularly DDT, increased food availability, and also reduced human persecution. Current Fish and Wildlife Service regulations allow for us to authorize the lethal take of migratory birds through two means, depredation permits and depredation orders. In response to the huge increase of cormorants in the interior region and increasing conflicts with public resources, the Fish and Wildlife Service established a public resource depredation order allowing 24 states the ability to lethally take cormorants committing depredation on public resources. Oregon was not a part of that original depredation order. It was confined, again, largely to the states in the Midwest. It was expected that, or the states were given the authority to kill up to 99,000 cormorants through this public depredation order. That was 99,000 a year, approximately 100,000 birds were allowed to be taken. During the history of this, generally, they've meant much fewer, many fewer birds have been taken, more about 40,000 a year. So they have a cap of 99,000. They've been taking about 40,000, again, to protect fisheries resources and other public benefits within the interior region. The Pacific flyway and Alaska populations were not included in that depredation order because during that same period of time, the population actually decreased 7.9%. So while we had tremendous increase in the interior populations, we were seeing a modest decrease within the population that we manage here in the Pacific Northwest. Figure 2 illustrates and compares the increased populations observed in the interior region, that being in red, versus those of the Pacific flyway region, which is the blue bar. Again, dramatic increases in the one, modest decreases in the population here in the Pacific Northwest. If you look at just sheer numbers of birds, there are about 260,000 nesting pairs in the interior population and about 29,000 nesting pairs here in the Washington and Oregon area. That depredation order was issued in 2003, and it was extended through 2014. It is currently under review for reauthorization and potentially an expansion of the geographic scope of that depredation order. The current timeline for that review aims to complete a final supplemental environmental impact statement and proposed regulation by late 2014. This regulation, if promulgated in a timely way, if that were to occur, realistically, lethal control would not likely be an available tool until the summer of 2015. So we're 2013, so approximately 2 years, assuming that depredation order goes through in a timely way, that's when we would have the ability to lethally control cormorants potentially in this area. As we went out with that proposed regulation, we asked all the states who would want to be in, who wants in under this depredation order. And in this case, the states of Oregon, we worked with ODFW, we worked with Idaho Department of Fish and Wildlife. They decided they wanted to have the ability to be within this depredation order, and also the state of California. The state of Washington did not opt in on this, they did not request to be a part of this depredation order. The public scoping for this is going on now. We are very hopeful that this process occurs in a timely way and that we get out this proposed regulation by the summer of 2014 or late 2014. Our migratory bird staff, Nanette, recently came from our Washington office, so she knows this process as well as anybody. We are working here in the region with our headquarters staff so that they understand the pressures, the concerns of cormorants here in the Pacific Northwest as a part of that regulatory rulemaking process. So we are there with them. This is not being done by people in D.C. that have no appreciation for some of the pressures, some of the concerns that we have here in the Pacific Northwest. If that depredation order goes through in that timely way, and if it withstands legal challenges, which it likely is to have to withstand, then the state of Oregon would have the ability to lethally take up to a certain cap of cormorants under that order. The state of Oregon and the great expertise that's in ODFW would determine how and where those birds should be taken. We would be, of course, working with them hand in glove. But in that case, you don't have to come in for an individual permit because there's a global permit, basically, that has been approved. And then each state is allocated a certain ability to control cormorants within their state boundaries up to a certain maximum so that we conserve that species, the cormorant, and don't potentially put it on in a declining track that would lead to other protections potentially coming into place. Until that order is finalized, we have the ability to issue depredation permits. Those are specific permits, oftentimes targeted at state level or below, that we have the ability to issue. Ron had said that the state of Oregon came to the Fish and Wildlife Service and petitioned us to have a depredation permit to manage cormorants. We determined, for us to look at those depredation permits, we have to look at what is happening in the flyway. What is happening with, because we manage this bird on a flyway basis. We don't manage it on a river basin by river basin basis. As Ron had indicated, some research that had been done in the Halen Bay showed that birds go up the Puget Sound. So we have to look at this globally. We don't want to address an issue on a local basis only to find that it creates a problem for somebody else, another one of our neighbors, downstream, upstream, north to the south of us. Figure 3 is a map of basically the Pacific Flyway, and it indicates the known locations of breeding populations of cormorants within our area. And so, again, the size of the dots equates to the number of breeding birds that are available, that are in each one of these areas. And again, this is approximate numbers. As Ron had indicated, we don't have precise numbers because this is a bird that we have not had to manage and had to find the numbers out. It's something that it's been more of a recent turn of events. We have been managing waterfowl for 75 years. We have 75 years worth of data on breeding populations, whether they're going up, whether they're going down, how many birds are per clutch. We have a robust data set for those birds that we have been managing for a long time. But we have never been in the situation of having to manage non-game birds in a similar way. This is something new for us, just as it is new for our state counterparts, and we're developing that data as quickly as we can and as best we can, but it is an imperfect data set at the present time. Since the Over the last several years, we've determined that the estimated breeding population for the Pacific flyway is about 30,000 nesting pairs of birds, 30,000 cormorants, 30,000 breeding pairs of cormorants. They have been increasing about 3% per year between 1987 and 1992. Local population growth rates have varied, and while breeding birds in populations in some areas are increasing, in other areas they're decreasing. If we look at figure four, for the committee, we developed a graph that shows the double-crested cormorant population estimates in the Pacific flyway across the flyway, but then we segregated out what's happening in the Columbia River estuary, which is within our region, the place where we've seen the growth, the greatest dramatic increase. Figure 5 shows the population data for Oregon, and in Oregon, excluding the Columbia River estuary, the double-crested cormorant population has not shown a change really since 1990, staying at approximately a steady population number of about 3,500 birds. The big increase within the Pacific flyway has been East Sand Island. And as Ron had indicated, East Sand Island now has the largest breeding colony of double-crested cormorants anywhere in the world. Because of the documented impact of cormorant predation on ESA-listed salmon and steelhead stocks in the Columbia River estuary, the Corps of Engineers is developing a management plan for and an EIS for the East Sand Island double-crested cormorant colony to reduce impacts on ESA-listed juvenile salmonids. The Fish and Wildlife Service, Wildlife Services, another federal agency, WDFW, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife are all cooperating agencies in this EIS process. A draft of that is scheduled to be published this fall. Public comments will be incorporated into a final EIS, which is expected to be released in the summer of 2014, with management being able to be implemented during the spring of 2015. So we have the depredation order in play. We have specifically identified a challenge, a resource challenge within the Columbia River estuary. The natural resource agencies are working with the Corps to address that simultaneously while we're looking at this larger depredation order. But again, what we're seeing here is we're seeing that while Representative Krieger indicated that there is a great need and a great public outcry and a desire to move quickly, the public processes that we have to engage in are somewhat cumbersome, they're lengthy, and we're methodically working our way through them because the challenge that you always lose is the challenge of a misstep in a public process, in a NEPA process. And so, again, while we know there is a sense of urgency, and we feel that sense of urgency, we're trying to methodically work through these processes in a way that shores up our defenses for challenges that will surely come. But again, depredation order looking at, again, the end of 2014, with potential actions being able to be implemented in 2015, the lower Columbia River estuary, East Sand Island, the huge increase in cormorants there. Again, the management actions, which could flow out of that EIS, again, probably wouldn't be, those tools wouldn't be available to us, to ODFW, to Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, until the spring of 2015. As Ron had indicated, Mr. Chairman and committee, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife applied for a depredation permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service to lethally kill cormorants in three coastal estuaries, Tillamook, Rogue, and Umpqua. After reviewing that permit application, and I believe that was last year that we received that permit application, we determined there was insufficient information to support the issuance of that depredation permit. And what does that mean? For us to issue the ability for ODFW to lethally take these birds, we've got to be able to establish a causal link. Listed salmon here in the Umpqua are being eaten by these birds. We know cormorants eat fish. We know that cormorants are eating listed fish in the lower estuary. But we've got, to, before we can issue a permit to allow these birds to be lethally taken in those three estuaries, we need to be able to establish a causal link that says, yes, these birds are eating an inordinate number of listed species here, listed salmonids here, and we know then that if we implement those actions, they're likely to have an effect, the effect that we all want, less predation. We know that cormorants are very, we call them a very plastic species. They can nest in a lot of places, and they take advantage of food resources that are available to them. They'll eat whatever is out there. And so we've got to make sure that if we're going to kill cormorants in the Umpqua estuary, that we know that they're eating the salmon that are of concern to us. Let's see. Because we felt that that conclusive data was not available to make that causal link, what we did is we issued the state a scientific collecting permit. And under that scientific collecting permit, ODFW is authorized to kill up to 50 birds in each one of those estuaries. Those birds can then, we analyze the stomach contents, and if those stomach contents do provide us that scientific basis to say those birds are eating listed salmon, then that provides us with the data that we need to issue that permit. Because again, while there are many people that would prefer there be no cormorants in those areas, we have other publics who are very interested in birds that say think that we don't have enough of them. As you know, as public servants, balancing the many publics that never speak with one voice is always a difficult thing to do. And the best thing we can do is rely on sound science to develop that cause-effect relationship so that we can document that when we issue this, that there will be, that we have every reason to believe that there will be the impacts or that we hope to occur. We work closely with ODFW. We have identified the data that we believe is necessary to allow us to understand the issue in those three estuaries, and then that would guide us in issuing potential permits or depredation permits in those areas. This is a dialogue. I try not to act in a manner that the feds go back into a dark room and they make a decision and issue a decree. I worked half a career for the state of Kentucky. I was a state director of a natural resource agency in the state of Kentucky. I know how important it is for at the state level to be able to be responsive to the publics. I try to bring that history, that knowledge, that half a career with me to the federal government. And so we try to have a collegial relationship, a collaborative relationship with the state, and I think we do. We have a lot of gnarly issues from wolves to cormorants that we work through on a daily basis, and we try to have it as a dialogue. And we have requested data for up to 3 years. 1 year worth of data is just one data point. We try to have three. You know, I'll admit to you, as scientists, you never have enough data. There's never enough to make a decision. But that is not acceptable in the public arena. It's not acceptable to me. And so what we've said is we would like to have 3 years worth of data to be able to establish those causal links. But at any point, during those 3 years, as data comes in, we are always willing to sit down with Ron and his staff and look at that data. And if it's showing a definitive trend and definitive direction, then we're willing to sit down and look at that and try to make a reasonable decision, because we're public agencies, and we need to be responsive to the public, and we need to have robust data, but we don't have to have perfect data, and so we try to be reasonable there. And as I said, we have basically now three processes in place. We have the scientific collecting permit the ODFW has. We've asked them to look at creating 3 years worth of data to allow us to decide whether or not we can issue a permit in those three coastal areas. Again, as data comes in, we want to sit down with our colleagues and look at those data and then come to reasonable decisions about those. We have the depredation order that's being looked at nationally. Oregon has been asked to be included in that process. We believe will conclude towards the end of 2014, with, assuming it gets passed, Oregon is included, and when we are supported in being able to have that lethal control as a tool in our toolbox, then again, that would probably be the spring of 2015 before that would be available. The third component is specific to the Columbia River estuary. It's the Corps of Engineers is the principal on initiating that effort. We are colleagues with them. We are collaborators with them, as is ODFW. Again, that very public process will conclude again in about the end of 2014, again, with the first ability for us to use that as a management tool, whatever tools come out of that, this spring of 2015. I know each and every one of you would like me to be able to come here today and say that we can initiate actions, lethal actions today on cormorants. We do not have the data to be able to do that. We have to, and whatever decision we make, we're going to make in a very public process, because there are many publics out there with many voices. So I guess I will conclude there. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, any questions that you would like to ask, we're willing to try to answer them. If we don't have the answers today, we'll try to get them to you. This is a huge issue. I had to go to Washington and be with the head of NOAA, the Department of Commerce, with the head of BPA. This is an issue of great interest in the Columbia River, because we are producing the Fish and Wildlife Service hatcheries. We have 15 hatcheries within our system, 17 within the Lower Snake. We produce over 60 million salmon smolt a year in the Columbia River. It's unacceptable to us and the public that 25% of them get eaten by birds also. There's a public investments, and there needs to be a return on those public investments. But we need to, whatever we do, we need to do in a measured way. We need to be able to have the science behind us to make those decisions. And I can assure you, we are willing to look at all the tools that are available to us, and we're willing to implement those tools. But again, we're going to do so in a very public and open through a public and open process. And we will be challenged on probably any decision that we make. What I will commit to you today is that that this has been an issue, and it continues to be an issue. And I will give Roy a call, Roy Elliker a call, and suggest to him that within the next 30 days we sit down and have a discussion and look at, you know, let's look at cormorants in Oregon and look at what all the various processes that are in play and see, are there other things that we need to investigate, other things we need to do in the interim. Everybody, the state has the ability to do non-lethal take, and Ron had mentioned that. You can haze birds. You can disturb nesting areas up until the point of nesting. There are things we can do in the interim. But typically, on this issue, when I've been sitting in this chair, what people really want to do is they don't want to haze them, they don't want to harass them, they just want them to go away. And we've got to just make sure that whatever we do so in a thoughtful way that doesn't create problems elsewhere. Chairman Witt and members of the committee, anything you would like to ask, please.
Mr. Hannon, thank you so very, very much. I just want to tell you that it is so encouraging to hear your perspective, in contrast, I think, to some of the opinions of other federal agencies, and sir, something that goes to the heart of the issue and it involves a good deal of what the rest of us may view as common sense action is very encouraging. And I would also say that we very much respect the fact that you're looking for sound science and that kind of science that will make your ultimate decision legally defensible. For all of that, I want to thank you. And with that, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. On figure three, the bottom of Oregon, I assume the second largest breeding nesting pairs are on Upper Klamath Lake. Is that correct? Okay, so since we don't have any anadromous fish there, what are they eating on Upper Klamath Lake from 1 to 5,000 nesting pairs?
I don't know. I can try to find out for you.
Could I suggest we are overlaying with two biological opinions for endangered species for mm-hmm. fish, and there are two sucker fish mm-hmm. in Upper Klamath Lake that are being eaten into oblivion, apparently, and it's costing this region a massive amount of money because of these biological opinions, and I might suggest that this would be a really great place to see how many of these fish are being destroyed by this massive breeding amount of cormorants. I mean, to me, this just looks like this is a real possibility for why we are not restoring the sucker fish population in Upper Klamath Lake, if you have that many breeding nesting pairs there. Maybe some work could be done on that.
And again, I don't know the answer to what they are eating. Nanette, are you familiar with the science there?
Not specifically for the Klamath Lake area, but just little I know about fishery biology and how the cormorants feed. I'm not sure if maybe they are going after sucker fish, just in terms of their cormorants feeding behavior, but we can certainly follow up and look at that. But when they nest in freshwater areas outside of estuaries, they do eat a wide variety of freshwater fishes that occur in the lake systems or river systems.
Well, apparently the National Academy of Sciences has found we have a certain population. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of sucker fish being hatched. And then they're disappearing between the time that they're being hatched and are really little to maturity. And nobody's been able to figure out since 1986 what's happening. And maybe we should make this a priority, given that this has billions of dollars of effect in this area. So
again, I wish I had the answer to that, but we will try to get the answer for you. And
thank you.
And if those information are available, Mr. Chairman, if I could, we could get that information
thank
to you.
Thank you very, very much. This is a great concern. Committee members, I just call your attention to remaining 5 minutes, and I would like to give Mr. Steele an opportunity to testify today. Are there any further quick outstanding questions? Yes, Representative Clem.
No question. I just want to say thank you for coming. You know, I've been on this committee now for 6 or 7 years, and often we have dialogue we'd like to have with our federal partners, and it's not always the case that they either feel comfortable or do come. I don't know which. So it's really helpful to be able to talk. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I mean, anytime you have a question about a natural resource issue for which the Fish and Wildlife Service has has some degree of authority or responsibility, then I'll be glad to be here. And I'll bring whomever I need to from our staff to do that. We are partners with ODFW. They're a hugely contentious issues in natural resources, as you know better than I. But we need to be responsive, and that's what they pay me for. And I'll be glad to be here anytime you have a question that concerns fish and wildlife issues.
Well, sir, it is refreshing. The approach that you take here, and on behalf of our committee, I want to thank you so much, Ms. Sato, as well. One final question. In addition to the request that ODFW is put in to be included in part of the permitting process for lethal take, is there anything that would be benefited by the legislature taking any kind of action, seconding the request that ODFW has made, sending a letter? Is there anything that we could do to help enforce or what's already taken place?
Mr. Chairman, I can't really think okay. of any. I mean, the state has asked to be included as a part of this depredation order. That carries all the weight, I think, that it needs to. We are supportive of the state being included in that depredation order. But if it's the will of the chair in this committee that to send a note to Dan Asher, the Secretary of the Interior, reinforcing that, then far be it from me to suggest that you not pursue that.
We have full faith in ODFW. And with that, thank you again so very, very much. Certainly appreciate you being here today. It was absolutely tremendous. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And with that, I'd like to call up Stan Steele, and in 2 minutes, have him finish this informational hearing.
You gave me 2 minutes?
Yes.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele. I'm an Oregon angler who's been real involved on representing the Creators Committee, working on this issue for several years now. And I gave you a discussion document. And, you know, we do not disagree that it's going to take cooperative management, cooperative effort to actually come to solutions that are agreeable to not only Oregon, but to the birds, from suckers in the Klamath Basin to beautiful rainbow trout in Cream Prairie Reservoir. But what's interesting to us is when we look at what the feds have done since we really started getting interested in this in 1995, when they sent the first letter out to the state of Oregon. You know, Oregon responded that they did want to be included in the initial federal public resource depredation order, EIS, and were rebuffed because we didn't have the information. Well, they're the administrative agency of the Migratory Bird Protection Act. They really don't get into the field. However, let's give an example of recent photographic surveys done on the Oregon coast that sat on someone's shelf and weren't reviewed. They didn't know what was going on with Oregon's coastal cormorant population because they hadn't reviewed their aerial photographs. So consequently, we're always going to be getting more research. Research is abundantly clear. We're losing 66%, 74,000 out of 120,000 steelhead smolts that are costing you $287,000 a year to raise at the LC hatchery, to an unknown mortality cause, which most likely, talking to the biologist, our biologist, state biologist in the LC Basin, are double-crested cormorants. This is a population that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says doesn't even exist. There's over 300 to 500 birds there today. They don't exist because they're not breeders. They're sub-adults. Sub-adults are not counted in their surveys. It's a nesting survey. Everything's based off nest counts. So for every bird that they're talking about of 13,000 breeders on East Sand Island, national data and our own data says that there's going to be 1 to 4 subadults. Now, a subadult is a fledged bird. He eats the same amount of smolts or suckers as an adult. So let's not cherry pick the data, but let's understand that we do have a significant problem in Oregon with double-crested cormorants. And what we've been trying to do is make sure that when Oregon's research is used, so Michigan, there's their EIS, can get their PRDO, Public Resource Depredation Order, using our data, that we can at least use our data also to get that same process. I talked to several regional people in other regions of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when we were researching this process. How can Oregon enhance our capabilities of getting to where we need to be, the end game? And they said, you guys are in a region that is known for being overly protecting. Well, that might be it. And we've had several discussions in the past several years, and what we keep hearing is more data, more data. Now, they require more data. They don't pay for the data accumulation. ODFW has not came to you folks in either the Senate or the House and asked for an enhanced budget to perform the data. We're never going to get there. Let's be real. If we don't get the money, we're not going to do the data, accumulate the data, and so we're not going to get there. This is an issue that is statewide, not just Columbia Basin. As a matter of fact, the Columbia is an epicenter of something that could be growing statewide. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Stephen. And with that, I'm going to have to adjourn the informational hearing. And we are, as a committee, we stand adjourned. Representative Krieger, before